podcast and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Althea Billings, Eric Tegadop, Isabel Charlet, and Eric Galatis. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell. Glad to have you with us. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. Up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Xi Jinping congratulates Trump and urges cooperation. Germany's political crisis and the methane problem is deepening but may be solvable. First, Xi Jinping congratulates Trump. The prominent theme of Xi's message and subsequent Chinese commentary is increased China-U.S. cooperation. In his November 7 congratulatory message to President-elect Trump, Xi said, quote, "A stable, healthy, sustainably developing China-U.S. relationship fits with the common interests of the two countries and with the expectations of international society. I hope the two sides will keep to the principles of mutual respect, peaceful coexistence, and win-win cooperation, strengthen channels of dialogue, improve control over differences, expand mutually beneficial cooperation, and move down the road of correctly getting along in a new period with prosperity for both countries and benefits to the world," unquote. The most important follow-up was by an editorial collective that goes by the name Sound of the Bell. It said, quote, "Win-win cooperation is the trend of the times and should be the bottom line of China-U.S. relations. The writers reminded the U.S. of our economic interdependence. Today, China is the third largest export market for U.S. goods, and the U.S. is China's third largest trading partner. Over 70,000 U.S. companies invest and operate in China, and exports to China alone support 930,000 U.S. jobs. Last year, 1,920 new U.S. companies were established in China, and 80% of U.S. companies in China plan to reinvest their profits this year." The commentary underscored the message by noting, quote, "As permanent members of the UN Security Council and the world's two largest economies, China and the U.S. should become a stable source of world peace and an engine of common development. Over the past year, China-U.S. diplomatic, financial, law enforcement, climate change teams, and both militaries have maintained communication, sending positive signals to the world. Currently, whether promoting world economic recovery or resolving international and regional hotspot issues, China-U.S. coordination and cooperation are needed," end quote. How or whether the next Trump administration will respond remains to be seen. But judging from Trump's first administration, the China hawks who have advised him, his latest foreign policy appointments, such as Mike Waltz and Marco Rubio, and the hostility to China in Congress, it is highly doubtful that cooperation will have priority over competition. Indeed, in the House, We already hear of plans to move forward on the China Week agenda that I reported on a few months ago, an agenda that basically calls for a decoupling from China in multiple ways, including in educational exchanges, public health collaboration, and investments. Germany's political crisis. Germany's first ever three-way coalition, comprising the center-left Social Democrats, the Greens, and neoliberal Free Democrats, has collapsed, signaling the end of what the polls say is the most unpopular government of all time. In September, only 3% of respondents to a survey carried out by the pollster Allensbach said they believed that this government was still good for Germany. Some observers criticized Chancellor Olaf Scholz's leadership for taking prosperity and security for granted, and for failing to contemplate the need for change in the wake of the war in Ukraine, immigration, and environmental issues. One critic writes, for example, quote, "For a long time, we Germans thought we could outsource security. We also thought we could just ignore migration without needing to find a real solution. And we thought we could simply postpone all of the ecological disasters. But now we're living in a time when all the side effects of our actions are suddenly backfiring on us." Germany's main opposition leader, Friedrich Merz, criticized Chancellor Scholz as irresponsible for delaying early elections, as an opinion poll also showed voters in favor of an early vote to pull the country out of the political crisis. The methane problem is deepening but may be solvable. Methane, a gas that is many times more potent than carbon dioxide in its impact on climate change, is concentrating at a far greater pace than ever before. It has gone from 1,700 parts per billion in 2000 to 1,922 parts per billion in 2022. The basic problem is that global warming helps increase that concentration in the atmosphere, and that concentration then feeds back into warming. Now scientists are finding the cause of methane buildup. Microbes, the tiny organisms that live in cows' stomachs, agricultural fields, and wetlands. Oil and gas leaks and thawing permafrost in the Arctic are also responsible, but microbes seem to be the leading cause. And we humans are responsible for much of that methane production, from fossil fuels, rice cultivation, reservoirs, and other sources. Says one scientist, quote, "Methane forms biologically in warm, wet, low-oxygen environments. The wetlands of a rice paddy and the gut of the cow are all similar. And therein lies the opportunity to stem methane emissions." In other news, leaks of classified information from Benjamin Netanyahu's office may have ended a hostage deal. A breakdown in peace negotiations with Hamas may have been caused by leaked and falsified documents involving a close aide to the prime minister, an Israeli court has said. The leaking of the documents to Britain's Jewish Chronicle and Germany's tabloid Bild came at a crucial time for hostage negotiations. The documents claimed Hamas was going to smuggle Israeli hostages to Egypt, jeopardizing any peace arrangement. Commentators say the leaks were made to protect Netanyahu, who faces corruption charges. The aide has been arrested. Benny Gantz, who until recently was in Netanyahu's war cabinet, said that if sensitive security information was used for a political survival campaign, it would not only be a criminal offense, but also, quote, a crime against the nation. The leader of the opposition, Yair Lapid, argued that if the prime minister was aware of the leaks, quote, he is complicit in one of the most serious security offenses, and that if he wasn't aware, he shouldn't be in office. Families of the hostages stated that it is a moral blow that has no depth. This is a fatal injury to the remnants of trust between the government and its citizens. The latest figures on the costs of war in the Middle East for the United States. The highly reliable Costs of War Project at Brown University has issued a research paper on U.S. costs in the Middle East war from October 7 of last year to the end of September this year. By its calculations, which include spending in addition to security assistance to Israel, nearly $18 billion so far, the total war cost comes to $22.76 billion. One thing to note about that amount is that the U.S. is spending far more on support of Israel than on support of Ukraine, when you consider the respective populations of the two countries. Next, Israelis are evenly divided on peace or war. An Israel Democracy Institute poll at the end of October and early November found that 46.6% of all those polled believe Israel should pursue a diplomatic deal to end the war in southern Lebanon, while 45.8% think the fight against Hezbollah should continue. Among just Jewish Israelis, 54% believe the operation should keep going, and 38% back reaching an agreement. Among Arab Israelis, 88% said they back a diplomatic deal ending the war. As for the war with Hamas, 56% of those polled said that Israel should adopt a more flexible stance in order to reach a deal for the release of the remaining hostages, compared to 36% who said it should not. Among just Jewish Israelis, 53.5% said Israel should be more flexible, while 67% of Arab Israelis held the same position. President-elect Trump spoke with Putin about the war in Ukraine. The Washington Post reported that Trump advised the Russian president in a telephone conversation November 7 not to escalate the war in Ukraine and reminded him of Washington's sizable military presence in Europe. During the call, according to some sources, Trump, quote, briefly raised the issue of land. We know what that means. Asking the Russians to accept their territorial gains in Ukraine, which would include Crimea and parts of the Donetsk region, in a peace agreement. A Trump spokesman unofficially confirmed that conclusion by saying that peace, not land, is the new administration's aim. Two things to note about Trump's conversation with world leaders that are now taking place. First, Elon Musk is joining some of them, including those with Ukraine's leader. Interesting, isn't it, that a private citizen, rather than the next Secretary of State or Defense Secretary, would join Trump? Second, Trump is making an end run around Biden's State Department, which he distrusts and which in any case cannot share its intelligence or analysis with Trump officials unless and until he signs an ethics agreement as required by law. The last word for tonight comes from the late Alexei Navalny, the Putin regime's longtime nemesis who died in a remote Arctic prison February 16. Navalny, you may recall, was poisoned by a Putin agent on a flight to Moscow in August 2020, was treated in Germany, and then decided to return to Moscow in January 2021 in order, as he said, to tell supporters the truth. As he knew would happen, he was tried and convicted of extremism and other trumped-up charges. Here are a few excerpts from the prison diaries, which The New Yorker published last month. My approach to the situation of the regime's all-encompassing power is certainly not one of contemplative passivity. I am trying to do everything I can from here to put an end to authoritarianism, or more modestly, to contribute to ending it. Every single day I ponder how to act more effectively, what constructive advice to give my colleagues who are still at liberty, where the regime's greatest vulnerabilities lie. As I said, giving in to wishful thinking about when the regime will collapse and I will be released would be the worst thing I could do. Then Navalny writes that he's really in a good mood. Let's face it, he says, of course I wish I didn't have to wake up in this hellhole and could instead have breakfast with my family, receive kisses on the cheek from my children, unwrap presents and say, wow, this is exactly what I dreamed of. But life works in such a way that social progress and a better future can be achieved only if a certain number of people are willing to pay the price for their right to have their own beliefs. The more of them there are, the less everyone has to pay. And the day will come when speaking the truth and advocating for justice will be commonplace and not dangerous in Russia. But until that day comes, I see my situation not as a heavy burden or a yoke, but as a job that needs to be done. Every job has its unpleasant aspects, right? So I'm going through the unpleasant part of my favorite job right now. And now they're trying me in a closed trial in a maximum security penal colony. In a sense, this is the new sincerity. They now say openly, we are afraid of you. We are afraid of what you will say. We are afraid of the truth. This is an important confession, and it makes practical sense for all of us. We must do what they fear. Tell the truth. Spread the truth. This is the most powerful weapon against this regime of liars, thieves, and hypocrites. Everyone has this weapon, so make use of it. And with that important message for our times, that is the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I am joined by Laura Grimes, the Executive Director of Oregon Arts Watch, to get some added insight into some recent stories from the publication. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Thanks for having me, Althea.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Lots of interesting stuff for us to cover today. But let's start with the political. Part three of David Slater's coverage of the Supreme Court's decision in Warhol Foundation v. Goldsmith is out. And in this one, he's speaking with local arts community leaders about the impact of this decision. If you don't mind, could we first explain what that 2023 decision brought into the arts landscape?
Yeah, David Slater is a retired lawyer and an artist, so he gives a really interesting perspective from both sides. And this particular ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in late 2023 that Condé Nast, which published a magazine to commemorate the death of the rock star Prince, that they used this image by Andy Warhol, a screen print, and they ruled that they didn't have permission to use this print again, because it was based on a photograph by Lynn Goldsmith, and that they did not have additional rights. They didn't have the copyright to use that. And what this has done is it sort of turned the notion of copyright use on its head, and how the use of fair use of artwork that has sort of been our basis for judging copyright use for several decades now.
And it refocuses it, if I'm not mistaken, much more on commercial use and commercial competition.
Yeah, it's not so, focused so much on the artwork anymore, but now it's focused on how it's used, which is a really important distinction. So it affects how artists use it. So in this part three, the first part kind of explained the ruling, and in part two, he talked about the history of art and how artists have borrowed from other artists throughout time. And this third part, he talks with some local people about their impressions of it. He talks with Bruce Gunther, who's a curator. He was the chief curator at Portland Art Museum and other major museums around the country. And he talked with Bob Cox, who's the owner of Ogden Gallery, a major dealer in prints and photography. Talked with Laurel Reed Pavrich, who's an art history professor at Pacific Northwest College of Art. She's also our visual arts editor at Oregon Arts Watch. And he talked with Lydia Palace Lauren, who is a professor of law at Lewis and Clark Law School. What I found interesting is that the first three people who deal with the art world, the curator, the dealer, and the art history professor, they were all like, yeah, this ruling really isn't going to affect the creation of art. It's not going to affect us. I thought Bruce Gunther had a really important point. I thought it was interesting. He said, yeah, AI usage will just kind of blow past all of this. It's redefining the originality at every level already. So I don't see how this ruling is going to affect us. But the lawyer really said, yeah, this is going to affect a lot of things. So I thought that was that was really interesting. The one who really works with copyright law was going to say that it's going to have a major impact. It'll affect the choices that people make in creating art, especially the commercial use of it, which is for a lot of artists, that's how they make money. And at the very end of the story, it has a couple of short thoughts from artists who had a take on it. And they were, you know, people who read the first couple of works. And so I thought that it was kind of added at the end, but I thought actually getting the feel from how artists might decide how to use work was going to be, it's an interesting take. One of them was that, you know, they already borrow from other works. And so I wasn't sure how that was really going to change how they create art.
There was some really great pull quotes from all the folks that the author talked to. What I thought was interesting was what Professor Palace Loren mentioned about just sort of the balance of these cases, and that it will incentivize, you know, artists or copyright holders, you know, whoever's the push and pull of a lawsuit in this realm now, that it incentivizes a lot more settlement earlier on, just because it's like an expensive affair and worrying about that kind of a thing.
Yeah, the one quote that really stuck out for me that Lydia said was, it will dilute the power of the fair use argument. So right now it sort of shifts the balance of the state of the people who create the art and the people who are accusing them of infringing on copyright. So now that there's a lot of negotiating, it shifts where that negotiating begins.
And then if I could just quote, I mean, it is also very interesting that a lot of people that are in the arts in a different way than the copyright lawyer say, you know, it is what it is. We're not too worried about it. So, you know, that's sort of encouraging, I guess. But curator Bruce Gunther said, quote, "Today's artists will find a way to create/reinvent. And 10 years from now, this decision will be flotsam, washed up on the surrogate shores of the AI revolution."
Yeah, I love that quote. There were actually several good quotes in this. And also just, I thought the AI point was really good, in that if anything, what Laurel Reed Pavich points out is that what her students, what a lot of young artists are worried about, is that their own personal creativity is just going to get sucked up into AI, and people are going to use it at will. So there are a variety of interesting issues that come up with this story, I think.
Well, there's another story from Oregon Arts Watch written by Gabriel Lucich called Oregon Origins Project, Keeping Traditions Alive. And it covers a gathering at Reed College with tribal artists sharing their craft. Who were some of the artists at this gathering?
I wanted to talk about the Oregon Origins Project, which itself is just a fascinating organization. It was founded by Matthew Packwood. It explores how ancient origins of Oregon are expressed through creative work. So it really shares a sense of community and place. What is Oregon all about? It combines artistic work and sometimes science like geology. And so this particular event was a gathering of four indigenous artists and culture bearers. There was a basket and jewelry maker, a regalia maker, a jingle dancer, and a storyteller. And this is just one of many events that Oregon Origins produces throughout the area. So this has just happened to be one event, but it's kind of similar to what they do, in that they present cultural bearers so that we can kind of learn and get a sense of the deeper, more ancient history of our area. And it really brings together people and places to educate us about the importance of this. So the first artist who presented work at this particular event was Beth Ann Gibson, a basket and jewelry maker. And what I appreciated about this was how he talked about how basket making is a very long sort of conversation with the land, how these pieces that these harvested materials that are gathered to make these baskets are done over a long period of time. They have to know where they grow. They have to sort of make sure to farm those areas carefully so that they're nurtured. There's traditional burnings that are done so that the plants can be resilient and that they don't take too many of them so they can continue to grow in a healthy way. They might recognize where a certain area grows and they have to find out perhaps who owns that land and whether they have permission to gather it. So they talk about how it has to be weathered over time. It has to dry. Sometimes they might gather materials and they can't work with them for years even. And it's how they learn this art from other makers, other artists through the years, other culture bearers. So I appreciated how this story talked about the interaction that the artist has with the mentors that taught them how to weave, and also with the land. And it sort of was indicative of the other artists as well. There was J.C. So Happy, who was the regalia maker, who talked about the many mentors who helped her and who actually didn't want to be recognized for the work that she created. To her, it was about imbuing her regalia as a gift to the people who would use it and be able to then show it and teach other people. And there was, I hope I'm saying this name correctly, Ecosia Red Elk, who was the jingle dancer, and talked about how dancing was a real form of healing and being able to let go of emotions that build up in the body. Thought that was fascinating, and kind of came to dancing, I think by happenstance, kind of learned to express herself through that. And then the last one was Patricia Wereat Phillips, who's a storyteller, and talked about how language and words are really powerful and how we pass ideas on to new generations.
Yeah, there's a level of detail in the story that's really quite engaging with the nuances of how they came into their craft.
I really like that about this story too. You just felt like you were there. It really honored the people who were sharing their art forms. And I liked how the end of the story talked about how there is a round dance at the end of the evening with anybody who's in the audience. So there's a shared communal experience there. Yeah, the Oregon Origins is a fascinating organization. I think it's only really been around for a few years, but it's made a big impact on the area already.
One last piece I wanted to ask you about before we go. Arts Watch has a story looking ahead at some of the choir activity coming up in November. What can folks look for there?
Really wanted to talk about this story because Daryl Brown, who writes about choral music in the state, is just does such a terrific job. She is very well loved in the area, and this her whole work here is such a labor of love. And I really wanted to touch on this because Portland is a huge choir town in a huge choir state. It always has a lot of readership, a lot of following. And it was nice to see in Daryl's story that choirs are really coming back after the pandemic. It was difficult for people to gather and sing together during the pandemic. And there were a lot of really sort of resilient groups and performances that kept happening. But now that to see that the choirs are back to full strength. And so her story here on Oregon Arts Watch, Choirs Are Back. It talks about a lot of the fall concerts that are coming up, the revels that happen around holiday time, and the first stirrings of some of the holiday shows that are coming up. So it's a big, long kind of buffet of choral music that can be read here.
If our listeners are interested in learning more about any of the stories that we've mentioned today, what's the best way for them to do that?
You can read all these stories and more at orartswatch.org.
Any final thoughts, Laura, before we wrap up?
The only thing I was kind of thinking of is that it was kind of nice to end on choirs because, you know, there's just this balm about them. They're uplifting and healing, and I think everyone can use that about this time.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Yeah, always a pleasure, Althea. I really appreciate it.
That was Laura Grimes, the Executive Director of Oregon Arts Watch, speaking with me about some of the latest stories from the publication. More information is online at orartswatch.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea.
Fighting for survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, I wanna drive out to Seattle, where the used record stores have much better prices. But I don't have a car, and I don't have a license. Should I take another walk to the DMV? Get another learner's permit with a picture of me? I'd put it in my wallet along with my $4, and the condom that's still in there that has probably expired. I'd leave home for New York, but New York is where I'm from. I'm just looking for a way to feel my life has begun. Living in the city where I'm working like a walrus, but man, I don't need your money, man, I'm gonna be an artist. And I'm feeling like I wanna do whatever I feel inside. Put it all on paper and I'll hope that people buy it. And my only minor worry is how to pay the rent. But that
we're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public